Hello, and welcome to the Psych in Business podcast, where we highlight the integration of psychology and psychological principles into the world of business and organizations. I'm your host, Dr. Ernest Wade. All right, so I have a really, really great guest for you today. Her name is Nikki Taggart, and she is an organizational psychologist based in Ireland. Nikki works in the field of people, team, and organizational development, underpinned by the principles of organizational psychology and behavior. Nikki, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Ernest. It's a pleasure to be here in my first podcast interview. So yeah, excited.
Nikki, you're my first guest from Ireland. So first for all around then.
Nice one.
Yeah. Nikki, I always want to start by asking, how did you get into this world? Because I think it's so interesting when I find psychologists or people doing our kind of work doing consulting. So how did you get into this world, and what was your journey like?
Okay, well, if you're up for the longer version, So I'm from Northern Ireland, Belfast, and I wanted to get out of there whenever I was 18, and I managed to get a golf scholarship to America. So I did my undergrad in Pfeiffer University in North Carolina, a really small private college just outside, well, a little bit further outside of Charlotte than I might have anticipated back then. So I left September or August 2004. My parents took me to Dublin Airport, and they were crying their eyes out, and I was skipping away to my dream of America and the sunshine and playing golf in the sun. And I got there, and at orientation, they offered me the academic catalog. And, you know, it was kind of like, what major do you want to do? But in Ireland and in the UK, we can only do the majors that align to our high school classes. So for our last couple of years in high school, we only do 3 or 4 subjects maximum.
Wow.
For me, my subjects were French and Spanish and physical education, which included an element. So a third of sports science is essentially sports psychology. So with the other 2/3 being social sport or sociology of sport and physiology of sport. So when I went to open this catalog at Pfeiffer University, you know, I phoned my mom and was like, "Mom, I could be a dentist. You know, I can choose anything." She was like, "No, you cannot be a dentist. Seriously, Nikki, just go with something that you think is a bit more reasonable." So I chose exercise science, and I lasted about three classes in chemistry, and I realized I wasn't going to get through that. Conveniently, I had also been enrolled in Psych 101.
Nice.
So that was when I realized that this was a subject that I love to study. And for me, like in school, I only did well at subjects that I loved. So I could only really do well at things that I really, really got into and really got kind of obsessed with. So that's whenever the psychology journey started. I was really lucky to have some amazing professors there at Pfeiffer, one of whom had just left University of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. So Dr. Susan Wilkie came up to North Carolina and was a great professor. And one day after class, she invited me to her office. And of course, I got worried thinking, what have I done? What have I done?
Get called in, but, yeah.
She just asked me, she said, "Sit down, Nikki, what kind of psychologist do you want to be?" And I was like, "What?" You know, I just came to America to play golf in the sun and get my undergrad. I had never thought that I could be a psychologist. You know, I obviously had this limiting belief somewhere. So she really gave me that belief. And I think we always need somebody in our lives just to show, to tell us things that we don't think or we're not thinking about, or to give confidence in our capabilities. So I really put that down to her. It didn't work out for me to stay after I graduated. The visa situation was kind of tricky back then in 2008, with the financial crisis for non-Americans. So there were no jobs and hardly even college places for me either. So I moved to the UK just outside of London and got a job as a pharmaceutical sales representative. So I worked in that field for now quite a famous organization, Novo Nordisk. So the product I was selling was actually the first molecule of Ozempic. So that's crazy, gone viral, that product now. So they were a great company. And I remember on my first day looking up at the trainer, the learning and development executive, thinking, I think my psychology background would make me good at that job. Right. So the learning and development side of things. So I spent about 2-3 years selling as a medical pharma rep, and then got a break and got into the learning and development team. So that was when I was getting really excited about what I was doing and making a broader impact on people coming into the workforce for their first time. So I would have been leading all the induction and the onboarding for the new customer facing employees, as well as beginning to train managers and leaders on coaching skills, as coaching is a really big part of that organization's culture. And their culture always has been ahead of its time. That organization, Novo Nordisk, would have had a workplace wellbeing strategy, you know, in 2016, 17, when maybe even before that, 2013, they were starting to think about it. So really ahead of the curve, and same with their wish to create a coaching culture. So yeah, I stayed there for 10 years. They paid for me to do an MBA. And again, during the MBA, those numerical classes just made me realize that, you know, being a business leader isn't where my strengths will take me. Mm-hmm. So it made me really want to refocus and come back to work in organizational psychology. So then I enrolled in the University of Limerick on the master's program there to get my master's in organizational psychology and keep going towards that kind of lifelong dream that Dr. Susan Wilkie inspired in me to be a real psychologist one day.
Yeah, that's such an interesting journey. You've had such a fascinating journey in this world and have worked in a lot of different cultures and different backgrounds. And with the MBA, I think all of these things really helped to enrich the work that you do now, right? I think I'm a strong believer in that your past experiences can be very helpful to you in the work that you're doing now. So I really appreciate your background. Tell us a little bit about the work that you do now, because I know you work with individuals, with teams, and with organizations. Tell us about the kind of work that you do now.
Sure. So I left Novo Nordisk April 2019, and that was literally the same week as my last day of class and my master's. So the timing was good. And I started to lean on the work that I was already good at doing and already had a bit of a name for, at least in the pharmaceutical industry, because of my network there. Mm-hmm. So that was initially learning and development activities, usually team development activities. My thesis was on teamwork and multidisciplinary teams. So I studied one team in the National Pediatric Hospital here in Ireland, and was looking at the, you know, what influences are affecting effective teamwork within that particular context. Mm-hmm. And what came out was psychological safety, and influences of hierarchical power on teamwork and communication. So that led me to create my own framework for building or for training in team reflexivity. So reflexivity is the combination of collective reflection and subsequent adaptation that a team engages in. So the more teams engage in reflexive activities together, the more likely they are to be performing well, to be innovating, and also to have good levels of well-being as well. So I got a nice break off a former colleague that had moved to another pharmaceutical company, and I delivered some team reflexivity training there, which got scaled up to be an organization-wide delivery. So that was good, and that was what I was focusing on in 2019. And then, of course, we know COVID came in March 2020. Yeah. And at the time, my partner was pregnant with our baby. So we're two moms in our family. And we have now a 4-year-old, Nessa. So my partner was pregnant. I was working freelance. And then COVID happened and all my work got cancelled because it was all in England. That's where my network was. All my work got cancelled overnight. So I only had about 3 days of panic and stress, thankfully, because
only
I sent
3 days. That's pretty good.
Only 3 days, yeah, of thinking this is really bad. But I sent one person an email, and it turned out to be quite an influential person, as it happened, but I didn't really know that. And I said to her, look, you might want to consider developing some resilience training, because in my mind, I was thinking about all the pharmaceutical companies with sales forces that weren't able to go out and see their doctors anymore.
Yeah.
You know, so I was kind of worried for them. And I my friends were in that position from my old company. So I thought, well, they're all sitting there, you know, maybe so this is a good time to be doing some virtual resilience training. And so as it happened, the person I sent the email to, she was thought it was a great idea. She had said, well, that morning in her organization, the senior leadership were just saying we need to have some kind of well-being or resilience training for our employees. So then I ended up delivering it in that organization for about the first 2 months of COVID. And then that led to, so basically I got more work than I could have ever imagined thanks to COVID, because then that led to me meeting some very influential people in terms of Ireland and the world of work, and businesses and employers are all based in this particular organization. It's Europe's largest governmental lobby group, essentially. Wow. So they lobby on behalf of employers in Ireland. They lobby the government to create, you know, foreign investment and to look after organizations. You know, it's kind of a lobby group is how you would describe it. So there's a lot of people in there that have very big networks, and I was training them on their resilience skills. So then that led to me meeting some people in that organization, one of whom runs the, it's called the Keep Well Mark. So it's a little bit like Keep or Great Place to Work, you know, workplace accreditations, only it's all centered on well-being. So then that led to me being asked to become a workplace well-being assessor. Right. So once a week now, I go into a different organization, and based on a framework of workplace well-being, I do an assessment on that organization. I run focus groups. I interview employees and senior leadership. I grade them against this framework. And then I write up a report which has strategic recommendations for improvement based on not just what the framework says, but mostly what my eyes and my lens as an organizational psychologist see from working around the organization. And I have to say, that exposure to the diversity of workplaces that we have in Ireland continues to blow my mind. In terms of what jobs people have out there. So it's a really privileged role to have, because I'm always learning, getting to meet people at work, getting to talk to them and hearing their stories, which I love.
Yeah, yeah. I want to hear more about that, especially because we're talking about your work in Ireland, and there's definitely cultural differences in the work that you do there versus, say, the US. So I'd love to hear more about what you see in terms of how the people there adapt and cope to work, and how they even manage COVID as opposed to in other areas. That sounds so interesting.
Yeah, I suppose the first thing that came to mind for me there was that we have a lot of European, Middle East, Asia headquarters in Ireland because of low corporation tax rates. So we have a lot of the big US multinationals with their European and probably rest of the world headquartered over here. So I do meet a lot of the Irish CEO of those organizations, and they're often American because they've been transferred from their US base to lead the European.
That's where the headquarters are located. Yeah.
Yeah, but the non-American headquarters then come over are mostly in Ireland. So so that's quite interesting, because the feedback that I get from those American leaders, is different to the Irish leaders. So the Irish leaders are more aware of the importance of holistic workplace well-being. So I think my point is that I think organizational well-being is higher on the agenda in Europe, perhaps, than in the US, because I find in those one-to-one interviews, it's less of an interview because the US leader is asking me more questions on, you know, why this is so important here and what he or she needs to know and understand to be able to lead in that regard. So there's definitely cultural differences in how we view work, how we value our vacation. How, again, a lot of my friends from college, they work a lot. They work a lot more than we do here in Ireland. Their hours and their vacation days, you know, the Irish culture would view those vacation days, the lack of them, as criminal, you know. Which is kind of interesting. I guess in my own international work, so America's at one extreme end, the extreme other end would be the Nordic countries. So Denmark, Sweden, Finland, Norway, it's very normal to take a 6 to 8 week break in the summer. Production facilities normally close for August. Even Italy, the whole of Italy is off for the whole month of August. And I actually think in Italy, actually, they have quite an interesting way of paychecks. So their pay gets effectively split into 13 months instead of 12. And then the 13th goes into either a double paycheck at the end of the year or at the start of the summer vacation, or goes into the pension. So there's a lot of different variations, even within Europe, in terms of the value that cultures place on rest from work. I don't know. We all know that we need to rest to be able to perform. So I would wonder about the work, work, work mentality that we perceive in America, and the very low, relatively low amount of weeks off for a maternity leave.
You know, I think what you're saying makes perfect sense. I used to live in Spain. I lived and worked in Spain for almost 3 years. And I remember the work would shut down, right around lunch. I would take a siesta and people take a time to actually rest and really enjoy that time. And that's so different than the US mentality where, when I was working for larger organizations, I worked through lunch, I worked through lunch and worked through late in the evening. And so it's a totally different mentality. What have you noticed in terms of how that impacts teaming and teamwork in Europe versus as opposed to other places that you've seen?
That's a good question. I think there has been a shift in. So just because we value our time off more doesn't mean that people don't work through their lunch breaks and work late in Europe, right? I think there's been a shift, though, towards recognizing that we do need to pause in order to be able to perform as a team. I'm doing executive coaching, and I was coaching a leader in an organization here. And she summed it up so beautifully in that she really recognizes, thanks to her own leadership development experiences that she's had, she realizes that she can't ask her team to be performing at 100% all the time. So whenever she sees an opportunity for her team to, to reduce their efforts, she'll tell them all to go home for the afternoon. But she knows that because she works in banking, there'll be times when she needs them to work at 120, 140%, right? So she's really mindful of just keeping her eye on the workload, the future workload, and making sure that her team know that it's absolutely fine. And it's okay to just walk out, to leave your desk and walk out the door 2 hours early, because, it's like conservation of energy. So that's really positive practice as well. I think in terms of teamwork, we'll always get diverse members within a team. There'll always be team members who kind of take the load, perhaps. And I'm talking more in construction sectors, maybe team members that do all the work and that are great workers. And then there's other ones that might be slightly less engaged and, working as hard. That's quite normal. I don't know, in Ireland, culturally, leaders can have a hard time calling that out, team leaders. In Nordic countries, very direct, no problem calling that out. In America, I don't know where I would place that. I think probably better than the Irish at speaking up and telling people what they really think.
That's so interesting. I love the way that you described some of the generalities in the different countries in terms of how their leadership and how they're able to speak up in terms of managing their employees. I love your experience and all of the information that you bring to bear when you're doing these things, Nikki. And I know one of the things that you do that I really appreciate, because I love research, is that you really integrate that organizational and behavioral psychology into your work. Talk a little bit about why that's important to you and the impact that has on the work that you do.
Well, I think it's really important. It really differentiates psychologists from other people that deliver training and team effectiveness, right? So I think it also raises credibility as well. So I'm not saying that people that are not psychologists or that don't have degrees in or advanced degrees in organizational behavior don't always leverage the evidence. But I think our knowledge of that and our curiosity as to what really works and our desire, therefore, to be delivering an intervention that really can transform the problem that the organization is presenting us with, like, that's what I'm really passionate about. So it's less so because I do a lot of work in training and leadership development, I really want to be distance myself and be less, and in fact not be at all transactional, but be transformational in the work that I'm doing. And I think the only way we can do that is by being informed of the evidence and the latest research and where that's going. So for example, at the start of COVID, I did a lot of resilience training, and that kind of demand for that dropped. But funnily enough, I spent this afternoon writing up a proposal for a transformational resilience program for an organization. So so whenever I was putting that together, I was explaining why my approach is valuable compared to other versions of resilience training. So first of all, I asked the HR leader to consider it as sessions rather than training, because I think when people go into a training session, the expectation is already there, or a training event, a learning event, the expectation that it is transactional is already there. So the learner goes, sits down, looks up at the person at the front of the room and thinks, okay, they're here to teach me.
Yeah.
That is not always the best way to really make a difference for people. So I asked for sessions. Don't call it training, call them sessions. And I'm really looking at systemic thinking whenever I'm creating my approach in that. So really, we all exist in relation to what's around us, right? So a lot of leaders might ask me to come in and deliver a change or create a change in their organization, but they don't necessarily realize that they have to change as well. So I might be really successful, and this has happened to me before, being successful at the level of change that I was asked to deliver, but ultimately it was constrained in the system, in the bigger system. So that's really got me interested in ecological psychology, and thinking about that system and environment. So with this particular resilience, transformational resilience training or program that I was designing, it's all about more of a coaching informed by self-determination theory as well. So really respecting the individual's autonomy and their relatedness in their team, but also their competence. So our background enables me to better blend coaching in with training as well. So I'm taking a team and group coaching approach with the view to have that systemic team coaching in this resilience program morph into peer coaching whenever I'm gone, so that the value will keep being created itself.
That's so interesting. So you're really talking about it, going from that individual change to that organizational systems change, and making sure that the work that you do with those individuals actually becomes more of a cultural shift in the organization. And it's not just constrained to the people that you work with. That's so fascinating. I really appreciate what you're talking about there and the work that you do there. Nikki, how do people get a hold of you if they want to continue the conversation or get a hold of your services? What's the best way?
Yeah, LinkedIn is the best. Nikki Taggart, NIKKI is how I spell my Nikki. And then a Taggart with TAGGART. That's LinkedIn. My website is www.coolhouse.com/consulting. I'm just spelling a few of those words out because I know my accent won't come across on the audio so well to some people. But LinkedIn is really the best way.
Awesome. Nikki, this has been so amazing. I think we definitely need to have you come back, because I'm really interested in having you walk through that that organizational assessment that you do, I think that that'd be really helpful to really dive into that. But for now, I just want to ask, what's a tip that or a recommendation that you have for leaders of businesses or organizations out there, especially in this, you know, this day and age that we're all in right now?
For leaders of organization, I suppose I'm quoting somebody else's book, is Adam Grant's book called Think Twice that's out at the moment. Mm-hmm. To think twice. So thinking about what the problem you have. And then often I get asked to fix this problem, but actually the problem isn't always what the leader thinks the problem is.
Yeah.
So I would ask leaders to be open to getting the most out of any opportunity they have to, whenever they're speaking with a potential consultant slash partner to work with on any type of change intervention, and think twice about what the real problem is, and then be open to partner and walk shoulder by shoulder with your consultant, with the psychologist, to create the change together, as opposed to asking an external to come in and make the change.
Yeah, I hear that all. I hear that a lot when you're working with clients, is they think they know what the problem is and they just want you to come in and fix the problem. And very often you have to work with them to identify the root cause. And sometimes they're part of the problem, and having to get them to, you know, really be willing to engage in the change can be very challenging. So I really appreciate that advice. I think that's dead on. Nikki, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been so fantastic. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Ernest. Cheers.
Awesome. And to our guests, thanks for listening. We hope you'll join us next time.